Oh, okay. This day has been very strange, as you know, I think. So we're on no dualism. No dualism. And I have a few things to say, but I find it hard to talk about this because I think that, you know, with support and with effort and so on, you have to figure it out for yourself. And I think that's part of what he's saying here. He's saying, you know, that you should stop your mind, and then he immediately said, that all mean that your mind should stop functioning. I do mean that your mind should permeate, I don't know the word he used, but I'll say permeate your whole body. Okay. And I believe that I know what he means, but, and I can talk about it. However, I think in order to understand what he means, you have to practice hard and explore for yourself and come to understand it in your own body. And at some point, things begin to shift. And it isn't like it stays shifted all the time. It's not like you can't get freaked out or very separate and be holding onto me, mine, really hard and so on. But you can experience and have access to that place where there's not the separation, where there's not the directing, say. Where there's more, he talks, seems like every fascicle, so he talks a lot about accepting, he doesn't always say things as it is, but accepting the situation, whatever it is. And that's key. That's one of the ways I think about bowing. I think of it as laying down my burden, stopping fighting. And that's another way of thinking about not accepting things as they are, you know, sort of demanding or whining or whatever, that, you know, that I don't like this and I don't want this and I want it to go away right now. And it may be in words that are slightly less infantile than that, but maybe not so much. That non-dualism is just sitting yourself down in the middle of it. Not even sitting, just being in the middle of it. And it does come with practice. And it comes with, I think at the, I'm going to read the last paragraph, so I'm sort of getting ahead of myself. But, you know, it's hard. It's not easy. And he does say, you know, you have to make an effort, maybe a great effort. And it's, as I often say, you know, it's not an effort to get something or to get somewhere or to have something or anything like that. It's just an effort. He doesn't say it this way, but I like to say that, you know, that it's an effort to sit up straight. It's an effort to let go of discursive thinking. It's an effort to let go of beating yourself up. an effort to just be with your breath and your body. And to be open to what comes. And I'm reminded of my friend Barbara Cohn, who's come here a few times. And we were at Tassajara together for quite a while. And at some point she said, you know what I realized? I'm not afraid of being tired anymore. I'm not afraid of being tired anymore. I know I talked about this relatively recently, but I don't remember the context, so I'll just repeat. The thing is, you know, at Tassajara, you have to be in the Zendo by 4:15 a.m. The wake-up bell rings at about 4:15, something like that. And you leave the Zendo. You know, you leave the Zendo and you do work and you do other things, but at the end of the day, you sit a couple of periods and you leave the Zendo at about 10 after 9. And if you're really good at it, you get into bed by 9:30. So that's, you know, basically 6 hours sleep. So you're tired, even if you take a nap after lunch. You're tired. Who's to say it was a practice set up for adolescent boys to tire them out. But that's what we did. And, you know, usually when you got to bed pretty quickly and you went to sleep pretty fast, usually because you're so tired, you know, it wasn't that hard to get up. If you didn't fight it. Suzuki Roshi used to say that, you know, when the bell rings, get up. And it works much better. If you don't, you know, set an alarm for 5 minutes later and then press this snooze button or something. If you're fighting it, it's much harder. And I tried that one practice period. I tried just getting up with a wake-up bell, and it worked much better because I accepted it instead of fighting it and trying to do it my way. He talks in this chapter a lot about, you know, people saying, you know, everything is Zazen, everything is Zen, so I can just do whatever I want. He says, no, that's dualistic. That's, when he says form is emptiness and emptiness is form, he's saying that that's a dualistic. It's like here's form here and emptiness is over there. And that it's better to say form is form and emptiness, emptiness. So that each one is just completely what it is. And when the wake-up bell rings, you're just the wake-up bell. You're just a body getting, you know, brushing your teeth and putting on your robes and going to the Zendo. I'm going to digress just a tiny bit, which is quite a wonderful thing to do in the dark. And you can see the stars sometimes, depending on how dark it is and where the moon is and so on. It's a canyon, so you don't have a wide vista, but you look up, you can see the stars. Or you're walking in the rain. And it's pretty wonderful to go into the quiet Zendo, which back in the olden days was lit by kerosene lamps. So it's kind of dim. It's still dim. But it's on a dimmer and it's got electric lights, which is much safer and doesn't give off the fumes either, but it's not as romantic. But the key to that is just getting up with a wake-up bell instead of sort of fighting it and running in anxious because you're just about too late. Or being too late and then having to stand outside in the cold until Some other things happen and somebody formally opens the back door and you can go in that way. So there's a way in which if you just get up with the bell, that's not, it's not very separate. You're the bell, you're the zendo, you're the teeth you brush, you're peeing, whatever you're doing, it's just happening. And it just flows. And then you sit down and you give yourself a little zazen instruction and then you sit. Barbara also had, when she, the practice period before she was Shuso, before she was head student, they usually ended pretty close to the end. There would be a 7-day sesshin. And she told Mel after the fact, she told him that she had had the first time that she could remember, she had had a sesshin where she didn't have a lot of pain. And a lot of kind of discomfort. And he looked at her and he said, yeah, you accepted it. Yeah, this light bulb went on to you. That's true. That's right. So that was, you know, akin to not being afraid of being tired. And we have these experiences and we practice for them. You know, as you sit zazen and you come back from having gotten on the train of thought, or you sit up a little straighter, or you scan your body and you notice your mudra fell apart and you bring it back. And your breath and your belly is going in and out. And sometimes that's hard work. All right, and he talks about, you know, when you sit and your legs hurt, your knees hurt, say, or your back hurts. It's difficult to get to the point where two things, where one is where you don't make it worse by tightening around it or railing against it. And the other is beating yourself up about it. I'm not very good at this. I'm no good. I'm not a good Zen student. How come I can't just cut? He said stop your thoughts. Of course, he immediately says that doesn't mean to stop your brain functioning. So don't get caught by the stop your thoughts. It's not about cutting anything off. But it's completely about accepting it. You know, knees hurting or your back hurting, you know, unless you're like, you know, Kelly has sciatica, which is a whole different thing. But the kind of hurting that most of us have towards the end of a day of sitting or some periods of zazen, it's really not that bad. But we can make it bad by giving in. We have fear of it, or we're self-critical about it. You know, if only I did Pilates or if I did more stretches, why can't I do that? What's wrong with me? I'm such a failure. Well, that, or when is this period going to end? As a friend of mine once said years ago, about, you know, when you, you know, sort of trying to time the period and wondering when it's going to end, she said, that way lies the hell realm. And it's true. It's true. If that's where you want to spend your time, you're free. But the thing is, we do that. And it's painful to me to hear so many Zen students talk about it in ways that they're really hard on, so harsh and hard on themselves. It's not useful. Maybe that's how. What do you think about what I just said? I want to leave plenty of room for talking. Does this make sense? Does it resonate? Does it seem like I'm talking about something impossible? We're only available with a massive enlightenment experience. Asha, go ahead.
I don't feel like I've felt that experience that my mind is in my mudra. And I don't quite understand it. What you're saying makes sense to me on some level, but I don't know that I've really felt it in my body as a Zazen-ing.
Okay, well, I love this one. Do you have any trouble with knowing right and left? Some people do. My sister had a hard time.
Not as a general.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. So, put your attention on your left knee. Now, you just did that, right? You didn't say, now I'm going to put my attention on my left knee. It's this one over here, and you just did it. That's your mind and body in sync. So, it takes, I think, a significant amount of practice to stop talking to yourself about it too much during. I mean, I figured out that exercise because there was somebody that I used to work with in Pleasant Hill who just talked to themselves constantly. You know, and they would say to themselves, now I'm going to put my attention on my left knee, or now I'm going to do this or that. And they couldn't imagine not doing that. So I tried that after many other things, you know, and it worked, at least for that experience. And then they stopped coming, which happens sometimes, I'm sorry to say. Steve?
Yeah, I actually started coming in part because you later used that exercise on me. My story is that you, Mary, were giving a lecture at Berkeley Zen Center. I now don't remember what the lecture was about, but I do remember that I asked the same question that Asha just asked. I said, how do I keep my mind from telling myself and talk to myself about my attention? After that exercise, it was pretty much the first time that was clear to me. And so that really planted the seed that this could be a teacher of mine. Asha, I'm just saying it's really simple.
It's really simple and it's really hard.
Yeah, it's hard. It is.
But it isn't something... out of reach that only people that have big, huge enlightenment experiences have. It's a matter of just maturing in practice and doing it. And things change. Kate, you want to talk a little bit about your relationship with your mind and body changing over time? Is that okay?
I actually was going to say that I think when I read this 20 years ago, I don't think I understood what it was talking about. You know, I mean, I thought there was some state I was supposed to reach, you know. I thought that was the point of sitting Zazen. was to even though Mary repeatedly told me there was no, but I'm so conditioned to, I didn't know how to make an effort without expecting an outcome. It was kind of a foreign territory to me, that whole concept. Well, why try if there's no result? You know, it was, I don't know. And I think, I sat for a long time and I would get glimmers, I guess is the way I would, just enough to keep me coming back, you know, to not despair that I was completely failing. Somewhere he says, where was it? Just keep making the effort. You know, my effort was to just keep returning to my seat and coming to the Zendo and going to Dokusan. And I didn't understand. I didn't understand that sense in my, and I had a huge, I was saying this to Mary the other day. I don't know why I didn't get this line where he says to stop your mind does not to mean to stop the activities of mind. I thought that was that state I was supposed to get in where there was no activity and I was in some hopefully bliss state. You know, and I've had bliss states. They're wonderful. I kind of like them, but that isn't the point, you know. And like you said, Mary, it's very difficult to talk about, but what used to happen is I would catch myself thinking, and there was this character with a big stick going, bad Zen student, you know, go back to your breath. And it was kind of like that for a while. And I just kept, I don't know, that's not so strong anymore. Somehow when I come back to my breath now, it's a more integrated experience. It's not some other part of myself saying you need to return to your breath. There's just a different experience where I return to my breath. And it's not my mind returns me to my breath. It's my whole self returns to my breath. And I don't know how to say it any differently than that, but it's only been in the last couple of years that that's been true. So I hate to discourage anyone, but you know, I sat for a long time with a lot of glimmers here and there of that. And that's enough. I mean, it was enough for me to keep returning. Did that make sense, Mary?
Yeah. And you remind my friend Tia used to say, and I say this a lot now because I think it's really true. It's, you know, when you notice that you've been thinking, you're already present again. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to say anything. Just like you're putting your attention on your knee, your attention just returns to the breath. Or breath returns to the body or whatever. You know, it isn't, you don't have to do anything. And you certainly don't have to say anything. You're already present again. And especially the self-criticism or the self-flagellation is totally extra. And I think it makes it a lot harder. But, you know, I can't, it took me a long time to stop being self-critical. And I'm not self-critical about being self-critical anymore. And I'm not as self-critical as I was by a long shot. And I don't know. It does. I like the word. I think you said integrated. It is hard to talk about, but I think that's what he was talking about when he said that the mind, what pervades the body or something like that.
Right.
It's not a separate, it's just not a separate event.
Well, and he uses that word acceptance a lot. Acceptance. And he says, at first, it is difficult, very difficult to accept things as they are. You will be annoyed by the feeling you have in your practice, you know, and that's my, and that's the whole, you know, why can't I do this better? What am I missing? What should I be doing differently? Blah, 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 you know. But accepting that, right? Accepting the blah, blah, blah that makes it shift. Oh, you know, it's the blah, 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 blah again, you know, whatever it is, you know, whatever flavor.
So Dana, do you want to say anything? Will you please say something?
Yes. Okay. I struggle with this a lot, this whole chapter. I've read it many, many times, lots of marks. And I wrote down some things you said too. I really like when you said you're just happening. You said you're just happening. It feels very effortless, but also effortful at the same time. And for me, Zazen is definitely, I don't know that I touch any of these enlightenment experiences. I've been, like I've said before, so trained to be outside of my body because of suffering abuse as a child. Before I can even remember. So I'm letting weeds grow over the old path in a lot of ways. And so sometimes I get emotional when you guys are talking. I'm glad that I can be on mute and I'm glad that I can be on Zoom sometimes. Then I can be here when I have to talk. But being a friend to myself has been very healing in Zazen to feel this really tenderness of being with my body. I guess it's the closest I get to what I think is pure and untainted. That word that I struggle with a lot, and I write it down and I think about that word a lot. And it just feels like what it's all about, and I don't always arrive there, but when I do, it seems deeply healing and very natural and very, I feel made more whole by the experience of Zazen, because it's, for me, practicing to be with myself and finding that it's not horrific. It's actually what it should have always, it should be all the time. You know, the breath is there to love me from the inside out, to feel the feelings that are okay, the feelings aren't going to knock me off my feet, because it's okay to stay with them. And I'm talking too much, but it's really a non-duality. When I first was introduced to non-duality, I was with a guru, a guy who really thought he was Jesus's brother on a remote island doing yoga, and he was crazy, and he brought non-duality up as some other thing. And So I was really, really interested in reading this and gently touching it with my Sangha and hearing the beautiful way of you say it. You're just happening and you just flow and you just get up when the alarm goes off and you're with the alarm and you're with, you know, brushing your teeth and making your coffee or whatever. That's a lot better than the guru in the jungle and taking somebody else's anger into your body and having to leave your body to survive. You know, it just makes a lot more sense.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, it's down to earth. I think, and I just want to say, though, Dana, you're welcome to show your emotions with the Sangha. In person or on Zoom, it's really okay.
I know.
It's a gift that we give each other so that if you, you know, if you cry and then somebody else needs to cry, they know, oh, you can do that here.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Was that, Steve, was that about it to with Dana, or was that about to say that you wanted to say something?
I did want to say something, but I was waiting for the sound in the background to stop in my house so that I wouldn't be too distracted or distracting other people. I was going to say that that actually I found that, one, I'm capable of more emotion in front of other people than I thought. And that's been because of the support of the Sangha, and that people are a lot more supportive than I expected them to be. And that's harder. Everyone tells me it's harder for men, and I believe it. And then I'm also half English, which I think maybe makes it even harder. My dad finally started showing some emotion near the very end of his life. I was grateful that he did show some emotion, some positive emotion even, you know, but there's no real negative emotion. It's just sincere or insincere emotion. These days, I've almost felt like I get choked up when I want to talk much about the personal aspects of my practice, like something about this class, like several times, I've just felt like I started to get choked up about, like, one, how much effort it takes and how subtle the changes that come over a person through practicing are, that I almost... The choking up or wanting to choke up is sort of like a combination of gratitude and sort of almost like I feel bad that I can never really communicate what I've discovered because it's so down to earth and so nuanced that even I have a hard time if I try to put it into words thinking, well, has anything really changed? And I say that because I think it's actually... I found it hard to be encouraged by some practitioners who had been practicing a long time but hadn't really become teachers yet. They used to give talks at Berkeley Zen Center, and they would talk about how hard practice was, and I'd go, well, why am I even here listening to this guy who's still having a hard time practicing after 20 years and is wearing black robes? You know, as no one in particular, but this happened several times where people would, you know, it's... And I think they were trying to be encouraging, but it wasn't sitting right with me at the time. And also, it's very, very subtle what this practice can bring. But it's all worth it. And even if you start to talk and start to cry, I had to check in where I was having a lot of trouble talking about. I was having a lot of trouble with migraines, and I was having trouble talking because I was trying to get that off my chest. And I found that, you know, that was kind of a breakthrough in particular. There have been many, but, you know, we'll listen. You know, people listen here.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I need to remember that the first noble truth is life is suffering, you know, and so I don't mean to be glib about that. I think that's what you discover, really, when you sit down. You understand the depth of that. And it's encouraging. I mean, for me, because I didn't know anywhere else where I could, besides therapy, right? which is different. It's a different, it's a very different thing, the therapeutic container, you know. So, to, you know, we suffer with each other. I think that's part of the strength of our practice together as a Sangha. And having been around for a while, then you also were encouraged because you see those subtle changes in the people that are sitting with you over the years, you know. And it's apparent to me. I mean, I think, you know, seeing it in others is also an encouragement for me, anyway.
Thanks. I want to move a little bit. One of the things he said is to find your own. He was talking about that there need to be some restrictions that we all have. We have restrictions that there's, you know, something you don't like or pain in your knee or whatever it might be. I think he said he developed a restriction in his practice, and I'm not sure what he meant by that. But at any rate, he says to find your own way under some restriction is the way of practice. And I think it's useful to emphasize to find your own way, because you really do have to, you have to sit with things that are difficult and stay there or not, and find out that it comes back again, and someday you're going to have to just stay there. Or you find out that you turned away and for once you did not beat yourself up about it. That's a great fruit of practice. But at any rate, to find your own way. I think you do have to find your own way. I can talk about it, and we can talk about it, and we can read Suzuki Roshi about it, but it's your butt on the cushion, and you have to sit still for it. And that is practice. It's the sitting still for it and struggling with it, turning towards it, struggling with it, sitting still, turning away, gently turning yourself back, turning away, and coming back and sitting still and finding out that you can do it and you can survive it and that you don't have to beat yourself up if you turn away for a while. You may need a break from it. You know, sometimes it's not that big a deal. Sometimes it's fear of death, and that can be quite a big deal. To find your own way under some restriction is the way of practice. I think that's right. And you will find your own way, and you will find that you come to some deepening understanding of what it means for you to practice. That's why I love this practice and I love Soto Zen, because we don't tell you what you're going to experience. Because if I tell you what you're going to experience, you will experience it, most likely. But it's not yours then, and it's not in your bones. you know, it's not on the level of prajna wisdom. It's more kind of in your head. So to find your own way, find your own way. And how else could it be to be non-dualistic? You know, if you can't find my way, that's not yours. That's not integrated. You need to find your own way. And we're all here, and I'm here to support you. And I can't make it happen. I can't do it for you. And when you find your own way, I love this. He said, there's actually a koan, which I don't remember exactly, but it's kind of like when I'm tired, I sleep, and when I'm hungry, I eat. He says, when you sit, you'll sit, and when you eat, you'll eat. Without all the commentary. Just completely sitting when you sit. Just completely being the bell and the clothing and the toothbrushing and the peeing and the walking to the zendo and the sitting down and arranging yourself, however that is. Finding your breath and listening to the sounds, because there are various zendo opening bells and things going on. And then it's quiet. And you will find your way. It's your wake-up bell, even though somebody else is ringing it. It's yours. And you hear what you hear. And you are the creek. It sometimes is running high and sometimes not. And people hear all kinds of things in the creek. I tended to hear sort of brass bands. Other people heard other things. Some people had a hard time distinguishing the wake-up bell from the creek when it's running high. It's a joy and sometimes a burden that it's your practice. And when you sit, you sit. Your mind and body sit. Not separately. There's just form forming. And form completely forms. And emptiness is. Emptiness is. And they're not two, even though they're not one either. But that notion, when you sit, you'll simply sit. He didn't say that, but when you just sit. And it's your sitting. And that's the other thing I really want to emphasize, that it's yours. And it's your joy, and it's your difficulty. And I just want to read the last paragraph and talk about it. I think we've already touched on it some, but... He talks before, I'm going to leave sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, because it's too, I don't want to get into it. But he's talked about that before, that Basso, in Chinese it's Matsu, when asked how he was, he said sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Like, you know, maybe I'll live a day, maybe I'll live 100 years. Same thing. 100 years of life are good. One year of life is good. If you continue our practice, you will attain this stage. I hope so, but I have not attained this stage, that stage myself. I want the longer one. But at any rate, he goes on. At first, you will have various problems, and it is necessary for you to make some effort to continue our practice. For the beginner, practice without effort is not true practice. For the beginner, the practice needs great effort. especially for young people, it is necessary to try very hard to achieve something. You must stretch out your arms and legs as wide as they will go. Form is form. You must be true to your own way until at last you actually come to the point where you see it is necessary to forget all about yourself. I think that is part of the practice that experience that Kate was talking about. You know, you may not forget all about yourself, but it's just not as important. It's not so much in the middle, and it isn't so necessary to protect it anymore. Okay. You see, it's necessary to forget all about yourself. Until you come to this point, it is completely mistaken to think that whatever you do is Zen, or that it does not matter whether you practice or not. But if you make your best effort just to continue your practice with your whole mind and body without gaining ideas, then whatever you do will be true practice. If you just make your best effort to continue your practice with your whole body and mind. Just to continue should be your purpose. When you do something just to do it should be your purpose. Form is form, and you are you, and true emptiness will be realized in your practice. I find that deeply encouraging. I don't know how others of you experience it. And I think there is a great effort. I think that the effort may be, it just, the effort changes. It's maybe more subtle. But at any rate, we all make an effort, or we intend to. I intend to. But how does this strike you, this paragraph? Dana?
I said, ah.
Yes.
This, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, this I love. I love this one because it's so, like, I can't really touch it totally, but I love this. I have underlined it, and I had a heart drawn in here, of course. I just love this last sentence, form is form, and you are you, and true emptiness will be realized in your practice. And what I understand of emptiness so far is probably the definition, a little bit of the definition, which is empty of separate self, if that might be correct.
That's one good one.
One good one. So yeah. For a long time, I felt like I could only touch that feeling or that sensation when I was lost in the garden and truly thought I could lay down under this walnut tree. And if I turned into the dirt, it would be really great. You know what I mean? There was nothing that, it just felt so connected to everything. I didn't feel separate from any of it. And then time just goes by and I go, oh, it's been 3 hours.
Yeah.
So that's how I related to that before. And then not so much in practice, except a few times. I had a few times, but this is my favorite part of this is the end, as usual, the end of these little fascicles. And so when he's talking about make your best effort to continue your practice of your whole mind and body without gaining ideas, that's the harder part for me, without gaining ideas. I'm so used to, as Kate had said, having a goal in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I think what I'm working on the most for now. Try to just sit down. Just do that. Just do the practice.
Thanks. Anybody else?
I find it very encouraging, too. For some reason, just to continue should be your purpose. I find that encouraging. It's a good purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought my purpose should be something grand, you know, like I mean, we say, you know, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. But, and then we say, just to continue, he says, just to continue. I think that's how we save all beings. You just continue, you know. And a thing that made me smile in here is at the earlier, he says, when the Buddha comes, you will welcome him. When the devil comes, you will welcome him. And I'm like, I'm still better at welcoming the Buddha. The devil shows up, it still scares me.
Yeah.
But that's all right. You know, I'm not as freaked out by the devil as I used to be. You know.
So, Steve or Asha, you want to say anything?
Not being as scared as the devil reminds me of something that Ram Dass once said about after all the years of his practice, he never got rid of one single neurosis, not one. But now when he sees them coming, he kind of goes, "Oh, they're little schmooze." You know, they're all like,
yeah. He is wonderful.
I find it encouraging as well.
Well, on that note, shall we stop? So next week is Sajiki, and I'm going to get something out. I wanted to get past this class, but it's Sajiki next week.